The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Well, good morning. And I wanted to thank the Sangha members who offered those good words this morning. Thank you for that. So honoring the life and the work and the living legacy of Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. What is a bodhisattva? Enlightened being, an enlightening being. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all bodhisattvas, mahasattvas. Bodhisattva is somebody who dedicates their thoughts, their words, their actions, their energy, whatever they have to offer to alleviate suffering, to benefit others, which has to include addressing the suffering that is being created, that has been created, and the karma of that continues. It's real. It's a real vow. It's a real commitment. Buddha's practice and teachings are replete with practices, teachings that give voice to this, particularly within the Mahayana tradition. And it's really important that it doesn't just remain words that we chant or practices that we do on our cushion, but it's a living thing. And so we honor Dr. King, we honor teachers within our lineage. Really, anyone is worthy of honoring who acts in that way, lives in that way. In the Lotus Sutra, somebody asked the Buddha, how does a Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva who hears the cries of the world, how do they come and go in this world of saha world, this world of suffering and attachment and desire and greed and anger? How do they teach? What are their skillful means? How do they affect change for the sake of living beings? And it's quite a long passage, but the Buddha said, if there are those who need someone in the body of a Buddha, then they will manifest as a Buddha. If there's someone who needs a rich person, they'll manifest as a rich person. If they need a poor person, they'll manifest as a poor person. If they need a priest or a lay person, they'll manifest as a priest or a lay person. And I would add, if they need a Christian minister or an imam or a rabbi or an atheist, they will manifest in that way, that form. The bodhisattva, the Buddha said, takes on a variety of forms and goes about the land saving living beings, alleviating that suffering. And this bodhisattva bestows fearlessness on those who are fearful or in pressing or difficult circumstances. That's why they're called the bestower of fearlessness. And so this path of facing and accepting and healing, transforming, liberating our legacies, our particular legacies in this country, these United States, of genocide, of enslavement, forced enslavement of countless human beings that was made institutional, sanctified by legislation, perpetuated, and comes down to us on this day. And so that it has been said so often that to really understand our country, to understand ourselves, we have to understand these legacies. And that's a difficult education. It's a difficult thing to do, to turn towards and face not just the past and not just the ways it still exists in our institutions and legislation and today, but how it exists within ourselves, to recognize the ways in which it's in the water we drink, the food we eat, the air we breathe, And it is there alongside with many other things, like the actions of bodhisattvas, like Dr. King. I think of the relationship, the friendship he had with Thich Nhat Hanh, and how they surely recognized in each other that bodhisattva. Of course, Reverend King had different language for this. It's the genesis of our Beyond Fear of Differences work, that if we take our vows to alleviate suffering seriously, then we have to recognize, well, where is that suffering taking place? For whom? How does it come into being? Having been brought into being, how do we turn towards it, understand it? How do we shift it? How do we diminish it? And what are those conditions that rather than destructive of life are affirming of life, rather than excluding of human beings, are inclusive of human beings? What are those conditions? So that simultaneously we're diminishing and letting go of all that is destructive of life and strengthening and bringing forth all that is affirming of life. The Buddha called this right effort. So I wanted to draw a little bit from a speech of Reverend King's that he gave in Atlanta, my hometown, in 1967. So I was just nearing my 10th birthday, so I wasn't there at the speech. It's called Where Do We Go From Here? Gokhan drew a little bit from this speech. And in the speech, he begins, there's a long section where he talks and kind of lays out so much of the good things that had happened, the changes in legislation and policy, the desegregating, the opening doors, the successes of the civil rights movement and of him, his efforts, and all those who worked with him. Because throughout history, when there has been ever a person who's been instrumental in changing history, sometimes, all too often, in destructive ways, cataclysmic ways, ways that bring tremendous tragedy and heartbreak and pain and suffering, not just to the people directly involved, but to the earth in which it's happening. Every war is a war against the earth, but also then sets up karmically the continuation of that war, of that fighting, of that conflict, of that hatred in the people that live at that time and will live in future times. It continues. We see that everywhere. The ceasefire in Gaza that we have been wanting for so long is an example of that. Everywhere we look, wherever there is suffering that's created, it doesn't just arise in that particular moment. It's a continuation of suffering, of greed, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy, attachments that have been generated. And so we in our country have this legacy, a bright and shining legacy of a self-governing people, of, by, for the people, a brand new idea, well, relatively new, an experiment. And that was born in wisdom and delusion at the same time, was born in a great aspiration, and at the same time, without a reckoning of the ground upon which that great declaration was forged, so that that declaration of not just independence, but of self-governing, of wisdom, of equality, of everyone having a fair chance at life, liberty, and happiness, was not for all, by design, from the beginning. And so we have continued, Dr. King is a shining example of one who has continued to try and harmonize, rectify, repair, heal, fulfill that vow. Much larger, but not so dissimilar, really, in principle from what we do as individuals when we come into practice with our delusion and we take vows to free ourselves of that delusion And we carry that vow and practice it while we continue to live within our various forms of delusion. So in that speech, Dr. King said, there's a problem of power, a confrontation between the forces of power demanding change and the forces of power dedicated to the preservation of the status quo. Now, power properly understood is nothing but the ability to achieve purpose. It is the strength required to bring about social, political, and economic change. And of course he understood that that all had a spiritual foundation. He was a minister, a deep student and practitioner of the Christian faith, of the teachings of Jesus, trying to merge his life, make his life an embodiment of those teachings. So of course he understood that. And that this power that he speaks of is to achieve those purposes, and that the underlying basis of that, as his speech makes clear, has to be spiritually grounded. He says there's nothing wrong with power if power is used correctly. In our tradition, power is spoken of in a particular teaching as a way to transform negative actions. First, we need support. First, we have to recognize that there are negative actions that need transformation, but we need support. We need a teacher. We need guidance. We need somebody we can turn towards. Face-to-face teaching, the Catholic Church confession, we need someone to turn towards and acknowledge, witness that negative action. And then we have to allow ourselves to feel regret, right? That brings to life our moral compass. Not only do I recognize that I've done something that's harmed another, but I regret it. I have remorse. I might feel shame for that. It's a heavy burden. The Buddha said the weight of that burden is to ensure that we don't repeat it. And so regret. And then there has to be a way to transform that energy. We reflect on the conditions, the causes that brought us to that action. We take responsibility. We have the Gatha of Atonement. We reach out and repair or apologize or do whatever we can to alleviate the suffering that we've caused. We take what we've learned from that process and dedicate it to a renewed vow to live better today. Now that energy is moving forward. And then we have to have a resolution, a commitment, a vow to continue that, to live that. And in the same way, we can think of those four powers in relationship to others who cause harm. That's what they need too. This is just a Buddhist way of looking at this. But there are fundamental principles here. It has to be acknowledged. In some way, it has to be witnessed, right? No longer kept private or secret. It has to be brought out. There has to be a way of responding to it. Skillful means. Repair. And we have to be committed to that. And there are other ways of working with this within those four powers. To recognize that every harmful action arises from afflictive emotions. These are Buddhist teachings. And those afflictive emotions arise from distorted, confused, not true ways of looking at ourselves and the world. We can speak of those as our biases. That the attachment to the self biases our mind, creates a bias in our mind that tends to be slanted towards ourself, what affirms, what comforts, what reasserts, solidifies, protects my own sense of myself. That's why it's so painful when somebody offers constructive criticism or criticizes us. We feel threatened. The self is threatened. And then we see, then it also biases our mind against others. The same way we can solidify our own sense of self, we solidify others' selves. I mean, that's what all forms of oppression are about, is seizing on or making up, fabricating falsehoods deceptions, untruths, attached to certain characteristics, oftentimes unchangeable within a person because of skin color, because of gender, because of sexuality, because of age, whatever the basis might be, and then solidifies certain negative qualities into those characteristics, and then attributes them to a whole group, whoever has those qualities. Which for the oppressor, very conveniently and tragically, means I don't have to see you. It means I do not see you. It means I will not see you. Instead, what I see is my beliefs, my own mind, my indoctrination, what I have been taught, what I have not examined. And so I can reduce a person or group of people or groups of people to the simplest elements. So in a way, it's a way of creating a profound and destructive form of laziness. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to think. I don't have to reflect. I don't have to extend beyond myself. And that all of this is suffering, not just for the people that oppression is afflicted upon, but for the oppressor. And of course, they're not equal. But nobody succeeds here. Nobody wins here. Nobody finds peace here. Nobody's lives are fulfilled. In the same way that we are inextricably bound together in our suffering, we are inextricably, inescapably bound together in our alleviation of that suffering. That's why Reverend King, as I understand it, through the course of his dynamic and profound life, recognized more and more that it wasn't just a racial issue, wasn't just racism, that all forms of oppression had to be addressed. They were all connected. They all interdependent, all sort of made of the same stuff. And so he said, you see, one of the great problems of history is that the concepts of love and power have usually been contrasted as opposites, polar opposites, so that love is identified with a resignation of power and power with a denial of love. So, of course, he speaks from that place of love, which is so central and beautiful and wonderful about the Christian tradition. In our tradition, we also speak of the love of the Bodhisattva, which is a selfless love. We can also speak of it as compassion. And remember that compassion is not just a feeling. That's the danger of speaking of it just in terms of love, is that we think of it as just a feeling of love. And so if I don't have that feeling of love for you, then I don't have love for you. And that's not true. That's a misunderstanding or a profound limitation of love. That's why in Buddhism it's understood as a selfless, unconstrained desire to alleviate suffering. It's not just a feeling. It can function without feelings. I don't have to love you. I don't have to have a feeling of love for you, to care for you, to act on your behalf, to want you to be happy and free and joyful. Of course, if I have that feeling of love, wonderful. There's more contact. But it isn't dependent on that. It's very important. And he says, now we have to get this thing right. I love that. Come on, we have to get this thing right. What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love. And this is what we must see as we move on. And so we might speak of it in terms of wisdom and compassion. That power is our wisdom, right? It clarifies our mind. It helps us to relieve ourselves of our self-clinging and our attachments. It is spiritual power. Because all of that vitality and vibrancy and vigor and aliveness now is not going into constraining and limiting and confining and protecting and dividing and separating. it's not just for me, it's for everyone. That's the love of the Bodhisattva. But that without compassion, that power, that wisdom doesn't function. And the teachings are very clear about this. They say this over and over, particularly in the Mahayana. So Adada Rishi used to say that wisdom and compassion are inseparable. They have to arise together. That's why we practice them all the time together. The idea that we can just enlighten, I can enlighten myself and be an enlightened being and live like a train wreck is a profound delusion. The Buddha said that is never going to succeed. It's based on an entirely false notion, not just of the teachings, but of who we are. And so we think of love in Buddhism as our ultimate reality, as Buddha nature, the ground of being, as emptiness, as your true self. And love is compassion, loving kindness. And remember that, again, compassion is not just a feeling of wanting to alleviate suffering, but it's actively working on it. That's why all of the voices this morning were saying we dedicate ourselves to. And that compassion, to realize that self-nature without love, enlightenment without love and compassion, is inactive. And that love or compassion without realization can be just sentimental and anemic. And that what are the demands of love? So when we really commit ourselves to this path, when we do it at the beginning, we can't really fully understand the implications of that. That's probably best. Because if you came here for the first day, just for beginning instruction, and we said, okay, this is the deal. Or when somebody enters as a student or receives Chikai, in a way, I mean, really, it isn't hidden. It's all out there. But we just don't hear it yet. I didn't hear it. I mean, I would just like, yes, 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 no. Are you kidding? Like, I can't do that. That's not me. Maybe when I'm enlightened, so I'll enlighten myself first, and then I'll come over here and deal with the compassion part. Okay, can we do that? No, the answer is no, we can't do that. And so we have to deal with those things that are standing against. And Buddhism has been studying that for 2,500 years. I would venture to say, and I am biased and limited in my view, but I would venture to say that Buddhism has examined that at least as deeply, if not more deeply, than any other tradition, because it's at the very substance, the heart, the essence of Buddhist practice. Because if we don't understand that and are not working to, as he says, correct everything that stands against wisdom and compassion, then we cannot realize it. Reverend King goes on to say, now what has happened is that we've had it wrong and mixed up in our country. And this has led Negro Americans in the past to seek their goals through love and moral suasion, devoid of power. And white Americans to seek their goals through power, devoid of love and conscience. It is leading a few extremists today to advocate the Negroes the same destructive and conscientiousless power that they have justly abhorred in whites. I think here he's speaking about those who are not practicing nonviolence. He said it is precisely this collision of immoral power with powerless morality which constitutes the major crisis of our times, and it's not over. This is the great challenge, as he is laying out in the civil rights movement, certainly for Christianity, certainly for anybody who's trying to effect change, absolutely within the Buddhist path. That's why we have the paramitas, generosity, patience, joyful effort, meditation. Those are the practices of the Bodhisattva. The essential practices, which means we cannot, if we want to stand in the face of, understand, correct in the sense of liberate ourselves from, that which stands, seems to stand in the way, then we need to suit up, you know, we need to have skills. We need to have, we have to have things to draw upon. It's like, so what do I need for this path? So the Buddha said, you need generosity. You need to give. You need patience. You're not going to do it without patience. You need to be effortful and make it joyful effort. Understand what that means. That will be enormously helpful. People will want to come along with you if you do that. You will need meditation. You need to know your mind. Just straight up. You must know your mind. You need precepts. You need moral teachings. We have to live rightly, and we need wisdom. So Reverend King says, I'm concerned about a better world. I'm concerned about justice. I'm concerned about brotherhood and sisterhood. I'm concerned about truth. And I think what I hear in that is that's what I'm dedicated to. I'm concerned about understanding them, practicing. I'm concerned that they are brought into being again and again, that they not be lost from our world, that we be working towards these things. And he says, and when one is concerned about these things, one can never advocate violence. It doesn't work. He said, for through violence you may murder a murderer, but you can't murder murder. Through violence you may murder a liar, but you can't establish truth. Through violence you may murder a hater, but you can't murder hate. Through violence, no, quite the contrary. You generate more hate. Darkness cannot put out darkness. Only light can do that. The Buddha said hatred never leads to the alleviation of hatred. Only compassion, loving kindness does. These are principles. These are basic universal principles. That's why they keep showing up in these different traditions. That's how I'm sure Martin Luther King Jr. and Thich Nhat Hanh could sit down and know each other across their traditions. Know each other. To realize wisdom, we have to bring forth wisdom in our thought, in our speech, in our action. To bring forth compassion, we have to practice and actualize patience and loving kindness, acceptance and trust. Which means we have to deal with that very easy tendency to respond to hatred with hate. To respond to violence with some form of aggression. To respond to dominance with the desire to dominate. How many throughout history have railed against authority and wanting to bring it down until they were the ones in power? And then suddenly, authority is a good thing, and you got to hold on to it. And fortunately for us, these are not just words, Dr. King gave his life, literally gave his life for this. As Buddhists, we have these practices, these wisdom practices that have come down to us, been transmitted to us. And you know what that means? It means that they have been passed down from person to person, from a teacher to a student, from a teacher to a sangha. They're not ultimately transmitted through texts. Important though those are, they are transmitted through the life blood of human beings. That's how they've come to us. And that then becomes our, if we're a practicing Buddhist and care about such things, that becomes our then present responsibility to do the same. And in order to do that, we can't just have heard words from our teacher and then convey words to somebody else, but we have to actually have to be living that, embodying that. If we're not doing that, then people shouldn't listen to us. And we should be allowed, as we are doing that, to stumble, to periodically fail, to get lost. In other words, to not be perfect. Because we're not. And if that's the mandate, then I would say we should all go home, but that's not going to help either. So we have to have an accountability. We have to mean what we say and do what we mean. But we also have to have forgiveness. We have to allow ourselves on an enlightening path to not be enlightened. On a path of compassion and love to not always be compassionate and loving. And so we have these practices, metta practices, for immeasurables, exchanging self and other, sending and receiving. So Reverend King says, and I say to you, I have decided to stick with love. For I know that love is ultimately the only answer to humankind's problems. And I'm going to talk about it everywhere I go. I know it isn't popular to talk about in some circles today. Today, too. And I'm not talking about emotional bosh when I talk about love. I had to look that up. I thought maybe he just, I don't know, made that word up or something, but that means foolish talk, nonsense. He says, I'm talking about a strong, demanding love, for I have seen too much hate. And I say to myself that hate is too great a burden to bear. Amen to that. Hate is too great a burden to bear. And the fact that we people can so acclimate, accommodate, align with, make an ally, their hatred an ally, just is a testimony to our capacity as human beings to be sort of endlessly adaptive and oftentimes in the worst ways possible. We should never adapt, acclimate to poison, right? To that which poisons our system and poisons others. It's too great a burden to bear. Isn't that what drove the Buddha out of his beautiful, comfortable, wealthy home? What he was experiencing, we call it bodhicitta, his spiritual distress, was too great a burden to bear. He couldn't bear it anymore. He didn't want to bear it anymore. And so, Reverend King says, I have decided to love. If you are seeking the highest good, I think you can find it through love. And the beautiful thing is that we aren't moving wrong when we do it, because John from the Bible said, God is love. He who hates does not know God, but he who loves has the key that unlocks the door to the meaning of ultimate reality. Very much like commitment and vow. I have decided to go with Buddha Dharma. I've decided to go with wisdom and compassion. I've decided to stick to that. Because delusion, attachments, suffering, self-inflicted, other inflicted is too great a burden to bear, which is just another way of saying this life is too important to waste. It is too fleeting, too precious. As a human being, each of us has too many opportunities to influence, to bring benefit, to be positive, helpful, loving, compassionate influences in the world, to waste under the burden of our delusion. And so to think, I have decided to go with practice to realize and embody love and compassion. I have committed myself to studying and awakening a strong, demanding love, as he speaks of it, compassion, for I have seen too much hatred. I mean, how much of the distress that so many are feeling today is because of today's burden? And in many ways, the burden being inflicted by those who are carrying that burden and don't know it or don't care, or are gaining power or are gaining wealth because of the perpetuation of that burden. The pain and suffering is just a cost of doing business. And so that's why it's actually important to grow weary as practitioners of those, of our self-clinging, of our attachments, of our greed, of our anger, of all those things that stand in the way. Not so weary that we begin to shut down or that we become self-critical or punitive, but weary in the sense of being motivated to, I choose not this anymore. to seek what he refers to as a highest good. We call that our self-nature. And so I say to you today, my friends, Reverend King says, that you may be able to speak with the tongues of men and angels. You may have the eloquence of articulate speech, but if you have not love, it means nothing. You may have the gift of prophecy. You may have the gift of scientific prediction and understand the behavior of molecules. You may break into the storehouse of nature and bring forth many new insights. You may ascend to the heights of academic achievement so that you have lots of knowledge. You may boast of your great institutions of learning and the boundless extent of your degrees, but if you have not love, all of these mean nothing. I think of how the absolute statement of that, you know, I think of how that shows up in the Buddhist teachings. Shantideva says, in one moment of anger, you can lose all of the positive good you've done. Which is not entirely true. But there's a point that's being made, right? It's trying to get our attention. It's like to startle us. It's like, oh, something's at stake here, right? I can't make deals with reality. It's not a poker game. If I make it a poker game, the rest is already known. So he's just making that clear. You may give even your body to be burned and die the death of a martyr. You may... Your spilt blood may be a symbol of honor for generations yet unborn, and thousands of may praise you as one of history's great heroes, but if you have not love, your blood was spilt in vain. There are teachings that say that with all of the practices of offerings and prostrations and circumambulations and copying of sutras and all of the various merit-gaining practices, there are many teachings that say to have one moment of genuine practice, of turning towards wisdom and compassion, not only encompasses but surpasses all of those other. In other words, a practice that is directed towards your liberation directly is more important than all of those other practices. And so he says, what I'm trying to get you to see this morning is that a person may be self-centered in their self-denial and self-righteous in their self-sacrifice. Their generosity may feed their ego, and their piety may feed their pride. And so without love, benevolence becomes egotism, and martyrdom becomes spiritual pride. And so in our practice, we are on a path of non-attachment. That whatever we're cultivating, compassion, wisdom, whatever insights we have, whatever we do that brings benefit to others, to not create egotism, spiritual pride, attachments. And that is a disciplined, diligent, relentless practice, because our inclination to grab on. Right? I want to let go of my suffering self, but I want my enlightened self, and I want you to see it, baby. I want to write a book about it. I want to make some money off of it. And there's lots of that going on. And teachers for generations, hundreds of years, have talked about exactly that. It's not new. We have a culture and machinery that manufactures this. Perhaps more than ever, but the basic impulse has always been there. So to end with Reverend King's last part of this, he says, now if you'll let me be a preacher for just a little bit, well, what has he been doing? He said, one day, one night, a juror came to Jesus and he wanted to know what he could do to be saved. Jesus didn't get bogged down on the kind of isolated approach of what you shouldn't do. Jesus didn't say, now, Nicodemus, you must stop lying. He didn't say, Nicodemus, now, you must not commit adultery. He didn't say, now, Nicodemus, you must stop cheating if you are doing that. And he didn't say, Nicodemus, you must stop drinking liquor if you're doing that excessively. He said something altogether different, because Jesus realized something basic, that if a person will lie, they will steal. And if a person will steal, they will kill. So instead of just getting bogged down on one thing, Jesus looked at him and said, Nicodemus, you must be born again. In other words, your whole structure has to change. Perfect. He's saying, yes, each of these things has to be addressed, but each of these things, they're all together. They're all bound together. The Buddha understood that. And so Buddhist practice is dealing with those various aspects because they show up and they get in the way, but it's also always dealing with the basic structure. We call that the self. To be transformed, be liberated. We call that getting to the heart of the matter, realizing the ground of being. Within this mountain of form, there is a light, Master Yunmen said. Release your hold on the illusion of self and enter the hall of Buddhas. It's so wonderful to both have a person such as Dr. King as part of our living history, along so many others. As an example, as a teacher. And to have those examples appear in all of the different beautiful forms and speaking through different vehicles, different language, different relationships, but basically speaking one truth. Because that is universal. And so I think that's just some of the aspects of why it's so important that we honor Dr. King, both for this person, this very particular person who lived and worked and died, and also for everything that is larger, that is more. You know, our minds are magnets towards what is negative. Maybe it's biological, maybe it's evolution to get our attention to see where the danger is. But in that, so when we tend to go towards and sort of feed on all the negative, all the distress, all the bad news. But as practitioners, we have to know that's just a part of it. It's like we only focus on that which is binding within us, we're missing all the rest. And so to appreciate at a time when we are so aware and made so aware of all those who are out to cause a lot of harm, bring about a lot of trouble, that's going to affect lives, people, that we also see all the rest that there is. All the beautiful forms, all the 100 million ordinary acts every day that people are bringing forth just to, because they want to have a good life, live a good life, be a good person, do the right thing. I mean, if that wasn't in the majority, I don't think we'd be here. And so let's see that too. That's what we're working on the side of. But we just can't ignore the other side. That's the profound teaching of non-duality. There is no upward but for down. There is no right but for wrong. There is no enlightenment but for delusion. So we have to develop that capacity to hold the whole in ourselves and in others. To love our enemy. And all that that means. And that means just about everything. So thank you for being here this morning and for whatever ways, all the ways that you and each of us are trying to embody or dedicated to embodying this. That is what we are being called to.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.